I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, it's the Midday Health Watch. Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen joins me to discuss some troubling new data on Maryland's opioid problem and an effort by Congressman Elijah Cummings and Senator Elizabeth Warren to address it. The city has joined a lawsuit to stop the Trump administration's directives that gut the Affordable Care Act, and the fight continues against White House plans to cut Title X programs, which could change accessibility to reproductive health care for women. Also, the importance of breastfeeding and tips for staying safe in the summer heat. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins us with her review of Dave, a new political musical at Washington's Arena Stage. The Midday Health Watch gets underway right after these headlines. Good afternoon. Thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you've joined us for Midday. Today, it's another edition of the Midday Health Watch and another visit with Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen. She joins us every so often and brings us up to date on issues affecting the health and well-being of the people of Baltimore and beyond. Dr. Wen, good to see you as always.
Happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me back.
And if you would like to join our conversation, you can give us a buzz at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. You can send us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. You can also check us out on the WYPR Facebook page, where we are streaming our conversation. So first of all, Lena, the first order of business is to congratulate you and your colleagues at the Health Department, because the Baltimore City Health Department was named the Local Health Department of the Year. That's a big darn deal. This is the National Association of City and County Health Officials. That's terrific.
Thank you. I'm so proud of my team. I mean, I work with incredible men and women every day who are on the front lines delivering healthcare and protecting the well-being of our most vulnerable individuals. And this is not my award. It's not the mayor's award, although I know the mayor, Mayor Pugh, is very proud of us too. It's the award for all the employees at the Baltimore City Health Department. I mean, the National Association of City and County Health Officials represents thousands of local health departments across the country. And so for us to be recognized for our efforts to provide classes to kids, to reduce infant mortality, to save lives from opioid overdose, and to also involve all, it's not just us, it's also the other partners in our city, our community partners, our hospitals, our businesses. It's an incredible recognition, and I'm just really proud of our team.
So what's the metric? I mean, do they just crunch a whole bunch of data and they say, you know, how many teen pregnancies, or the rate of teen pregnancy, for example, which I know is down very significantly here in the city? I mean, do they crunch that kind of data with a whole bunch of other metrics as well?
Measuring success in public health is challenging,
yeah,
because it's also about where you start from. I mean, in Baltimore City, because of the many challenges we've had in poverty, in violence, in deep-rooted inequities, in redlining, in racial inequalities, I mean, if you just looked at health outcomes, that's not an appropriate way to measure how we're doing as a health department. And so it's partly the actual metrics that we have in moving the needle, the 2,600 lives we've saved from opioid overdose in the last 2.5 years, the 38% reduction in infant mortality in the last 7 years. But it's not just those numbers. It's also about the efforts that we've made to engage our community to deliver the services that are necessary for the health and well-being of our citizens.
Well, it's really terrific news, so congratulations.
Thank you.
An award once. I won the twisting contest on the Captain Peppermint Show in Dallas, Texas in 1962. My career has gone downhill since then. But that's, you know, I got to tell you, when you win these awards, it's just, as you know, because you just won one, it's a big deal. So I'm making fun, but it's great. I mean, it's really great. And I think people do have a sense that our community in so many ways is making some progress. I mean, there's an awful lot to be worried about. There's an awful lot to be concerned about. The challenges are real and significant. But I mean, I think it is valid to think that we are on the right path and making some progress in terms of overall public health here. So
that's right. And I'm glad that we as Baltimore City, are getting these types of recognition because it helps us to change the narrative. That yes, when you look at the numbers, the actual numbers around cardiovascular death or infant mortality or life expectancy, we're not doing so well. But there are deep-seated many years of reasons as to why that's the case. We can't just look at what's not working. We have to look at what is, and we have to look at the real examples, as we have so many of them here in our city, of people who are doing great work and making a real difference.
The city has joined a lawsuit, along with a few other jurisdictions, suing President Trump for intentionally sabotaging the ACA, known as Obamacare, which will increase, according to the suit, increase the cost of health coverage. Andre Davis, who's the city's solicitor, is a highly respected lawyer, former federal judge. What is the lawsuit alleging, and what do you hope to achieve?
So here in Baltimore, over 10,000 of our residents are enrolled in plans that were purchased through the health insurance marketplace. The Trump administration, in their efforts to intentionally, willfully sabotage the Affordable Care Act, means that up to 10,000 of our residents could become uninsured.
What recent directive is causing the ACA to be sabotaged? In what way are they sabotaging it?
There are a lot of them, including lack of marketing efforts, including the remarks that are made directly by President Trump to attack and undermine the ACA. It also includes the promotion of these short-term plans that are not actually health insurance. I mean, so many of these short-term plans, as an example, don't include you if you have pre-existing conditions. If you look at the list of exclusions, they include things like high blood pressure, diabetes, asthma, migraine. I mean, basically what every single person has. The pre-existing or the short-term plans, less than 38% of them, I believe, cover for substance use and mental health. And so I worry so much about our individuals who have the disease of addiction. If they're currently in treatment and then they lose treatment, and then they're told that they can opt into one of these short-term plans, but they don't cover addiction, then what are we doing? They may have no other choice but to overdose and die.
So just to be clear to folks who haven't followed this super closely, the Trump administration is now allowing people to leave. Heretofore, the ACA has required that the plans cover the things that you just mentioned, asthma, diabetes, substance abuse. The Trump administration is now allowing an exception for that, or allowing people to purchase plans that don't cover that kind of stuff.
That's right. And it undermines the entire concept of health insurance. Health insurance, as with any insurance, only works if we're all in it together. And what impacts one person impacts other people too. It impacts them directly. If one person is ill and they're spreading infectious illnesses like tuberculosis or syphilis to other people, that's a direct impact. There's also an indirect impact when it comes to cost, and that's where we come in. The Baltimore City Health Department, we provide safety net services for the uninsured and for the underinsured. We run two clinics in the city, Eastern and Druid, and we provide a whole range of services from opioid addiction and referral and treatment to HIV/AIDS treatment to dental care to high blood pressure and cancer screenings to lead poisoning prevention and asthma. If we increase the number of people who are uninsured, that will force us to either increase our budget. And where is that going to come from? We already operate on a shoestring budget. Or it'll force us to reduce our services. And so who are we going to cut the services from? What type of services for the most vulnerable are we going to cut? And for us, this is an economic issue. It's a cost issue. But most importantly, it's a health issue. I mean, I practiced medicine before and after the ACA, and I can tell you so many stories of patients who delayed their care or never got care and then suffered consequences like having leg amputations, being on dialysis, or dying because they didn't have health insurance. So there is a direct impact on our residents. And this is why Mayor Pugh and Solicitor Davis have Baltimore City as one of the four cities in this lawsuit against the Trump administration for sabotaging the ACA.
Is this, in your view, the most effective strategy to have some of these regulations reversed? I mean, a lawsuit, you know, with four cities, I mean, a city like Baltimore and the other cities, do they stand, do we stand a chance in having the Trump administration change its mind, given Mr. Trump's rhetoric ever since he started running for president, given the Republican Party's rhetoric about the ACA ever since it was passed. They have been saying repeal it, replace it. They haven't quite repealed it, lock, stock, and barrel, but they are certainly cutting away at it a layer at a time. Is a lawsuit, on behalf of a city against the federal government, the best strategic move?
I'm no legal expert, so I don't know about the chance of success of a lawsuit. But I will say this, that we joined, as you know, the lawsuit for the teen pregnancy prevention program. When our teen pregnancy prevention program was cut unexpectedly without reason, leaving 20,000 students potentially without evidence-based education. We filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration and we won that lawsuit. And now we have funding for this program that otherwise would have gotten cut. So there are examples of us being successful in this before. And for us, this is our last recourse. I mean, we would love to have had this not happen in the first place. If the Trump administration didn't sabotage the ACA, that would be great. Or if Congress stepped up and instead of trying to undermine the ACA, if they looked to protect it, to expand health insurance, that would be great. But I've never thought so much about our judicial system and the third branch of our government as I have in the last 2 years because of this is the last recourse that we have. If we don't have the other two branches working to improve healthcare, if we're getting these severe cuts that, again, for us, it's not a political issue. It's directly about the health of our residents. So if our only recourse is litigation, and if litigation has the possibility of working, then we need to pursue every avenue to defend the health of our residents.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is the health commissioner of the city of Baltimore. It's the Midday Health Watch. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page where we are streaming as we speak. Lena, we talk about this almost every time that you come visit, and that is the opioid epidemic and the challenges that you at the city level and folks at the state and federal level have about it. There are some new numbers just released by the state, and boy, they are not good.
That's right. About 2 weeks ago, week and a half ago, we received the new data for overdose deaths from the state of Maryland from 2017, which is quite delayed. And the delay is important for us to mention because it's almost a year behind. We received the last quarter data from 2017 in August, which is almost a year behind. And we need that type of as close to real-time data as possible to look to see where we are, to evaluate interventions. But nevertheless, we received the data. And in 2017, in the state of Maryland, there were 2,282 total overdose deaths in our state, which is a 9% increase from 2016, which is already the highest that we've ever had. And here in Baltimore, the numbers continue to escalate also. As with previous years, a third of the overdose deaths in the state occurred in Baltimore City, which is 761 of these. I want to point out one other number, which is that in Baltimore City alone, 573 of these overdose deaths in 2017 involved fentanyl. That's compared to 12 deaths involving fentanyl in 2013. It's a 5,000% increase in 4 years. It's terrifying to me because we have not even seen the peak of the epidemic. I can't tell you, nor can any other public health official tell you, that this is the peak, that 2017, 2018 is going to be better. I don't think so. I think it's going to be even worse. But it's so frustrating to me because we know what works. I mean, one more number, which is in 2017, here in Baltimore, everyday residents have used naloxone, the opioid antidote, to save 1,130 lives just in 2017. We are stemming the tide a little bit, right? We are saving lives, but we're having to ration naloxone. We don't have the funding that we know we need. I mean, and it's so frustrating because we know what works to address the opioid addiction crisis. And it's a crisis, as everyone says that it is. But why don't we have the funding that's necessary to get there?
And we should remind folks that as the doctor for the city, you have written a prescription for every resident of the city to get naloxone. So anybody can walk into a drugstore, right, and say, Dr. Wen's my doctor. She's prescribed, made it possible for me to have some naloxone, to have it in your purse, to have it in your backpack, to have it in your medicine cabinet at home in case you encounter somebody who is in the middle of an overdose experience.
That's right. And I would encourage everyone to visit our website, don'tdie.org, and receive your naloxone training, which you can do in less than 5 minutes online. Then you can go to any pharmacy in our city. We just recently completed a round of outreach to our pharmacists and our pharmacy techs to make sure that they all carry naloxone and understand the standing order and are following the standing order in their pharmacies. So we encourage everyone to carry this life-saving medication in their medicine cabinet and their first aid kit.
So with the rationing that has to happen, is it rationed to pharmacies? I mean, would you expect that there are some people who would go to pharmacies and they would say, we don't have any?
The rationing, this is an important point. The rationing is not because there's a drug shortage. There's no shortage of this medication. The shortage is with money. Pharmacies will have naloxone because you, if you went to your pharmacy, would be using your insurance to pay for naloxone. So there's plenty of this medication. The problem is that we as the city, if we are to purchase it, it costs $75 per kit. And if we are to provide $75 per kit to 620,000 residents, that's $49 million, which is almost twice the amount that the city spends on the entirety of public health in our city. So that doesn't make any sense. And so this is why recently Congressman Elijah Cummings and Senator Elizabeth Warren introduced the CARE Act, which is basically the Ryan White Act, which is for the HIV/AIDS epidemic, that for the opioid epidemic. And Senator Warren was just in Baltimore City a week ago with Congressman Cummings and others, and I had the opportunity to moderate a discussion with them about what's needed in our city. And what we need is sustained funding at an amount that's proportional to the severity of the epidemic and sent directly to local jurisdictions like ours. There is no need for the funding to go, first the state has to apply for it, then we have to apply from the state. That doesn't make sense. At a time of an emergency, that funds should be directly available to locals like ours because we know what works. We just need the resources to get there.
Dr. Lena Wen, she is the health commissioner of the city of Baltimore. This is the Midday Health Watch. That's our regular checkup with Dr. Wen. You can join our conversation when we come back from a break. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, to send us a tweet @MiddayWYPR, to follow me on Twitter @TomHall. WYPR. You can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. By the way, I didn't have a chance to mention this yesterday when we were talking about the racial climate here in the United States, but yesterday was Black Women's Equal Pay Day. That means that Black women, on average, needed to work all of 2017, plus they had to work in 2018 up until yesterday, August 7th. So all of 2017 through August 7th yesterday, just to earn what white men on average earned in 2017. I'll leave you with that as we take a quick break. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Quick word about tomorrow's program. We'll spend the hour talking about ways to improve Maryland's public education system with Dr. Britt Kerwin. He's the chair of Maryland's Commission on Innovation and Excellence in Education. It's better known as the Kerwin Commission. That commission released a preliminary report in January. I'll ask him when we can expect the final report. And we'll talk about education policy, particularly the challenges around the formula for school funding. So Dr. Britt Kerwin, he's my guest tomorrow right here on Midday. Later this hour, theater critic Jay Wynn Russick drops by with her review of Dave. That's a new musical at Washington's Arena Stage. If you've just joined us, my guest is Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen. This is the Midday Health Watch. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And you can find us on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Lena, one more quick question about the naloxone order that you've given, allowing any resident to get a prescription. I haven't done this yet. I've been meaning to do it, and I'm going to do it one of these days. If I go to my pharmacy and I use my private insurance to get a prescription for naloxone, would my health insurance company make an assumption that I have an opioid abuse problem?
It's a great question, and we hear it from time to time from individuals who are worried about their employers finding out somehow or their premiums increasing because maybe there's the assumption that they have an addiction. And I want to emphasize again, this is why the Affordable Care Act and the provisions for protecting patients is so important, because you are not allowed under the ACA to be discriminated against and have a higher premium because of your pre-existing conditions. So even if it were flagged that somehow you got naloxone because it's for your usage as opposed to save other people's lives, you wouldn't be, there would be no penalty to you. And of course, your medical information is private to you. Your employer does not find that out. So I would highly encourage everyone to go to their pharmacy and get naloxone. If you are on Medicaid, naloxone is a dollar. If you can't pay that dollar, it's free. Other copays may range from $10 to $40, but this is something that everyone should have it in their medicine cabinet to save a life.
Let's grab a couple of phone calls and we'll come back to some other topics that we'd like to get to if possible. Angela in Mount Vernon, welcome to the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Nguyen.
Yes, thank you so much. I'm calling because I sit on a few committees and councils that advocate around different health disparities. I am on the patient and family advisory council at Hopkins, and we have a program called...
Angela, let me ask you a favor. Would you speak directly into the phone? Your line's pretty rotten.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, that's a little better.
We have a program called Call to Care, and it's a program that provides support and resources for caregivers. And we have found that even amongst our patients and family members being served at Hopkins, a lot of them are not aware of this awesome resource. And I wanted to ask Dr. Nguyen if their website or if her staff has a way that organizations like ours, maybe even Mercy or University of Maryland, if they have programs like this that can really help to empower and improve the quality of care, not just of patients, but also caregivers, is there a way for us to contact them and inform them of the services that we provide to the public and to patients?
Great.
So that we can really outreach.
Yeah, thanks, Angela. Appreciate that call. You know, the challenges that adult caregivers face, they're significant.
Absolutely. And Angela, I'm glad that you raised this issue, because so often we don't talk about caregiving. We don't see how much of a full-time job it is. I mean, I'm at a young age, I became the caregiver to my mother when she was diagnosed with metastatic cancer. And nobody trains for this. Nobody prepares for this. Nobody's ready for it. Nobody asks for it. But it becomes our job. And so I understand personally how difficult it is. And we, through the Health Department's Division of Aging and Care Services, we have many programs to support caregivers. We have a conference every year in particular to give resources to caregivers. We've partnered with our libraries to have caregiver corners in several of our branches. And Angela, to your other question about the resources and how we compile the central resources, visit our website, health.baltimorecity.gov. I don't know if the call to care is part of our resources that we list, but if it's not, we'll make sure that it's up there. And we encourage everyone who has knowledge of resources that their organization may be providing or resources in the community to contact us at health.baltimorecity.gov, and we will make sure that we list your resources for our residents.
Thanks for that call. Angela, Melody in Charles Village, welcome to Midday with Dr. Nguyen.
Hello, how are you?
Good, how you feeling?
I'm well, thank you. I just wanted to take the opportunity to thank Dr. Nguyen and her staff for all the wonderful things I think they do here in Baltimore. She's such a worker, and she's a mother, and thank you again, Doctor.
Oh, that's so nice. Thank you very much, Melanie. Right. And I'll convey this to our incredible team as well at the Health Department.
All right. Thank you for that call. Speaking of being a mother, Dr. Nguyen, your son Eli has a birthday coming up in just a couple of weeks. He'll be one. And there's a bill that's been introduced in the City Council by Shannon Sneed, another first-time young mother with an infant baby who's been on the show before. Actually, last time Shannon was here, she brought the baby, and we had a great time. She has introduced a bill to improve lactation accommodations in the city. What's that about?
So I and every doctor and public health official can name 50, 100 reasons for the benefits of breastfeeding. It's good for the baby, to prevent infections, to ward off asthma. It has long-term consequences for that child's life. It's good for the mom. In both physical and mental health, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends exclusive breastfeeding for 6 months and then supplemental breastfeeding for a year or longer. The problem is, you can't just have a theoretical policy. You also have to have the resources and the support to do that. So when my son Eli was first born, I didn't realize how hard breastfeeding was. I mean, it's something that I just assumed was natural. I mean, it's been around since the beginning of time. And I didn't realize until my son lost a lot of weight and almost ended up being admitted to the hospital again for dehydration and jaundice, that he actually wasn't latching properly. And if it weren't for an amazing lactation consultant, I would have quit. Because I would have thought, this is just too hard. I'm not doing this correctly. I mean, I felt so guilty and so awful that I almost quit. And then a month
into... And here you are. You're a physician, right? You've delivered babies before. I mean, so if you have these challenges, you can imagine what someone who's not a medical professional might feel.
Yeah. That's right. And I have so many resources. I mean, I Googled videos on breastfeeding. I tried really hard. It's not for lack of trying. It's that the supports have to be there. But then there was a whole other set of challenges when I came back to work. So when Eli was about 4 weeks old, I developed mastitis, which is, it came from clogged milk ducts that then I developed a breast infection that became a total body infection. I was very ill. I had a high fever. The way to resolve the mastitis was that I began pumping breast milk. But I had to pump every 3 hours, day and night, to prevent clogged milk ducts. And I had to keep that up even after I returned to work. Now, I'm very lucky in that I control my own schedule for the most part. I have my own office, and my executive assistant, Jackie Anderson, who is a mom and a grandmother herself, installed paper blinds in my office, and I could pull them down so that I could pump. And we ended up scheduling a lot of conference calls instead of in-person meetings so that I could pump. I was very lucky that I could do that, but still, it was so hard to make it work and come back to work and be a mom and learn how to do all those things at the same time. I know so many moms who came back to work and realized they couldn't keep nursing, they couldn't keep pumping because their workplaces just didn't allow it. And then they had to choose between, do I keep my job that's necessary for my family, or do I do something that I know is the right thing for my child, but then I would have to lose my job. And so this is why the lactation accommodation bill that Councilwoman Sneed introduced is so important, because it's about saying, look, if we recognize this is the best medical policy, then we also need to have other supports in the community at work that allow for this. And we're not asking for very much. We're asking for a space, a private space in workplaces
that employers would need to provide to young mothers,
other than a bathroom. Because saying to someone you have to pump in the bathroom and take away the one bathroom for customers, for everybody else, is inappropriate. Also, would you want your food to be made in the bathroom? If not, then why would you want the baby's food to be made in the bathroom? But any space, it could be a closet. I mean, it could be a back area that nobody's using. It could be a conference room. And to give critically not just the space, but also the time. Another young mother that I know was...
About how long does it take to pump?
It depends on the mother. It depends on her situation. And the key is to allow adequate time for the mom based on medical necessity. Medical necessity. I mean, one of my colleagues is not at work, but a friend of mine had a situation where her employer only provided a space, but it was in a building, several buildings over, that required a 10-minute walk to get to. So she had a 30-minute lunch break, but by the time she walked there, set up her pump, she could pump for maybe 2 minutes before coming back. And a person has to at least pump for maybe 10, maybe even 30 minutes. And so having the space and the time are necessary if we are to really support women and families and babies.
So that's a bill that's currently winding its way through the council process?
That's right.
Yeah. And we just finished Worldwide Breastfeeding Awareness Week. 71% of mothers here in the city initiate breastfeeding, and that's actually up 25% since 2010. So there are more women choosing to breastfeed now rather than going directly to formula at infancy than before. So that's a good sign, isn't it?
Absolutely. Initiation is very important. that, and we're working closely with our hospitals to ensure that women are given the option and the education to do it. Women can choose formula, and there should be no stigma or judgment, but they should be provided the education, and they need to be provided the resources. Otherwise, in my case, if I was educated and knew all the reasons for breastfeeding, but if I didn't have the resources and the support, I wouldn't have been able to continue.
And 71% is pretty good, and it's up from 2010, but the national average is actually 81%. So we've still got a little work to do in that if we do want to have more of our mothers breastfeeding at birth of their daughters. Well, happy birthday to Eli. Let's talk real quickly about, you had a press conference a week or so ago with the congressional delegation to talk about Title 10. These are rules that are proposed by the Trump administration would create what people are referring to as a gag rule. Remind us what this is about.
Title 10 is the National Family Planning Program that serves 4 million women across the country. Here in Baltimore City, I and the Baltimore City Health Department, we oversee Title 10 funding for 20 plus of our clinics here. We operate 3 Title 10 clinics. The change by the Trump administration does 2 main things. The first is it cuts funding for clinics that are even associated with organizations and clinics that provide abortions, even associated with it. So we're talking about many safety net clinics that may have to close their doors if they don't have this funding. The other thing it does that is equally egregious is that it imposes the so-called gag rule, which is a direct censorship of physicians, nurses, social workers, and healthcare providers on what we are allowed to say to patients. So that even if a patient comes in and specifically is asking for information about abortion or has a question about abortion, there is a script that doctors now have to follow of saying that they can't speak about this issue. Which, I mean, it goes against every value that I have as a physician, as a healthcare provider. It undermines patient rights. I mean, I think about, what if this were any other illness? What if it were diabetes and a patient comes in and says, I want information about insulin? And the doctor says, oh, I can't give you information about insulin. And I can't even tell you where you could get information about insulin. We don't do that here. In fact, I'm going to tell you about a miracle herb because that's what we're supposed to do. So that's why 2 weeks ago, the entire Baltimore City federal delegation stood with me, with the mayor, and with healthcare providers, doctors, nurses, medical students from across our city. We had dozens of them standing with us to say, this is something that's horrible for our patients. And it also doesn't make sense. If the goal is to reduce the need for abortions, why are we cutting family planning and contraceptive services, number one? But number two, this is not the kind of medicine that we can practice. This goes against our fundamental values as physicians.
These rules at the moment, as we speak, are proposed regulation changes. They haven't gone into effect yet. Is that right?
That's correct, except that there's nothing that needs to occur for them to go into effect than the Trump administration saying they are in effect. Mm-hmm. This is a unilateral decision that the Trump administration is proposing to make that will have a negative impact on 4 million women or more across the country.
Another couple of questions on email about naloxone. Bobby writes, with regards to knowing when naloxone is appropriate, how does someone differentiate from a person who's really high and nodding out and doing the heroin lean that we see on so many street corners in the city, and Bobby's exactly right, from how do you distinguish between that person from someone who's overdosing and at the risk of death and in need of naloxone?
That's a great question. So two things. The first is that if somebody is overdosing, they are unresponsive and they're not breathing. If somebody is talking but just maybe they look like they're high, maybe they look like they're falling asleep, but they're breathing and they're responding to you if you shake them, then they do not need to be given naloxone. The second important thing to mention is that naloxone is safe, it's effective, and it doesn't have side effects for somebody who is not on opioids. So let's say that you're not sure if somebody overdosed from opioids, but maybe they overdosed on alcohol, maybe they overdosed on benzodiazepines. It's still safe to give them naloxone or Narcan because it will save their life if they're overdosing from opioids. If they're not, it doesn't have an impact on them.
Here's an interesting question that comes from Ray on Facebook. Could naloxone be kept in your car, or would the heat impact the drug?
We generally advise that, as with other medications, that you keep them in an environment that is not 120 degrees as your car may get to. But that said, many individuals, including our paramedics, first responders, our police officers, do carry naloxone in hot areas by virtue of their job, and naloxone is still effective. So I can't give the specific guidance for at what temperature and for how long it may be effective, but I would say if you have naloxone available and somebody is overdosing, even if you've had it in your car for a long time, please use it because it could save that person's life.
Yeah, it's worth a try. Susanna writes, why has drug legalization not been discussed more as a remedy for the opioid epidemic? I mean, I wonder, in public health circles, given the severity of this epidemic nationwide, CNN reports 175 people a day die in the United States from an opioid overdose. Has the conversation about legalizing certain kinds of drugs, intensified?
There have been discussions around the safe injection facilities, which I know you and I have talked about before. The idea that this is a harm reduction practice similar to needle exchange. If somebody is addicted to drugs anyway, they're going to be using drugs. Why not provide a safe space for them to use it? That way they can be monitored there. If they overdose, their life can be saved there. Public health circles are certainly beginning to talk about these concepts. The proposal has been floated in Philadelphia, San Francisco, in other areas. Our concern here in Baltimore is twofold. One is that we don't know about the legality of these safe injection facilities. We need guidance from the federal Department of Justice before we can proceed, because we don't want the rest of our federal funding to be put in jeopardy. And the second is that we need to focus on evidence-based methods. There are evidence-based treatments for opioid addiction available. We have not even reached close to capacity for those things. So before trying something new, which may be effective, and maybe we should look into it, but we need the legality first. But before we do that, there's still this whole other capacity that we need to explore.
Yeah, just exhaust option one before going to option two. Let's sneak in one more phone call. Dan in Baltimore, welcome to the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Nguyen.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me. This is going to be another thank you part of the call, and then I have a comment. Dr. Nguyen, every time you and I have actually met a couple of times in front of a grocery store, I'm a high school teacher, and every time I hear you talk, become one of my heroes, because you serve the city and the country like a biblical prophet, because you comfort the afflicted and you afflict the comfortable. So I can't thank you enough. And the second, my observation that maybe you could comment on, is that the Republicans, certainly not just them, but the right to life folks, talk so often about the human being's right to life. It seems to me that it's just a natural segue from having the right to life to the right to health care. Like, they seem to go hand in hand. They're almost the same thing. And so I was wondering if you could maybe comment on that. But thank you for all your very, very good work.
Thanks, Dan. You know, this conversation about the basic human right to health care has been going on ever since the Obama administration proposed the ACA.
First of all, thank you, Dan. And I do remember meeting you, and thank you for your good work and teaching so many students. I cannot agree more that on two things. First is that there has to be a fundamental right to healthcare. It's a fundamental human right that should not be based on our ability to pay. I mean, that's what upsets us on such a fundamental level, that you should not be able to live or not live depending on whether you're able to pay for your health care. I think you also brought up another issue, which is that, if dare I say, of hypocrisy, which is, and let's take the Title 10 issue for a moment too. The same individuals who are against government interference on other issues somehow think that the government should interfere in what a doctor is allowed to tell a patient and in what type of legal medical services that patient may choose. And it's that type of hypocrisy that we need to call out, because it's not serving our patients well, it's not serving the health of our nation, and it fundamentally conflicts with our core values.
Dr. Lena Nguyen, she is the health commissioner for the city of Baltimore. This has been another edition of the Midday Health Watch. We'll have a link to more information on the health department here in Baltimore at wypr.org/midday. Always good to see you, and again, happy birthday to Eli.
Thank you.
Coming up after a short break, theater critic Jay Wynn Russick joins me. She's got a review of a timely new political musical. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR, where you're listening to Midday.